welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, April 30th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. The weather for today promises to be mostly sunny, and our high is expected to be 84, and the low tonight, 58. The main story on the front page, blood supply at critically low levels. This is reported by Michaela Rahm from Cedar Rapids. The COVID-19 pandemic has pushed the nation's blood supply to critically low levels, and with summer's typically low donation rates around the corner, blood centers and health care organizations are urging residents to give blood soon. Canceled blood drives and fewer donors at local blood centers over the past year have left the nation with a severely depleted blood supply. The blood center that supplies many Eastern Iowa hospitals said it is facing critical strains this week on certain blood types, reporting only a one-day supply of O-negative red cells, the first blood type used by hospitals for traumas and other emergency medical care. It also reported its lowest supply of other blood types since the pandemic began, including 2 to 3 day supplies on B negative and O positive, respectively. And because blood centers across the country are experiencing the same critical levels, they are unable to share with other centers to help alleviate the strain. It's a concerning situation to be in, said Amanda Hess, Director of Donor Relations at the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center. We don't have surge capacity. We're there before a disaster happens, but it's important that blood is on the shelf first. Blood transfusions are common for patients who need emergency care or who have a major surgical procedure. Patients with illnesses that cause anemia also often receive blood transfusions. There are no substitutes for blood, and because these products have a limited shelf life, the U.S. supply must constantly be replenished by donors. The Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center supplies donations to 120 hospitals in Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, and Wisconsin. Those hospitals require about 3,600 red cell donations each week to meet patient needs. But over the past year, the blood center has collected only 3,200 to 3,300 donations per week on average. In general, blood collection is operating 10 to 20% below pre-pandemic levels, Hess said. This overall loss in donations each week means that instead of maintaining a 5 to 7 day shelf life of all blood types, we have regularly experienced a 3 day supply or less, Hess said. Of 59 community blood centers in the United States, 19 blood centers had a 1 day supply or less as of Thursday, according to data from America's Blood Centers. An additional 14 centers are operating with a 2 day supply. The Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center has seen a 30 to 40% loss of donations from mobile blood drives per week over the past year when compared with a typical pre-pandemic year, officials said. Mobile blood drives at high schools and colleges are typically the biggest source for collection at the blood center, but many events were canceled in 2020. Loss of school-based blood drives is particularly challenging for blood centers as these events tend to attract larger volumes of donors and donations per event, Hess said. Between January and June 2019, the blood center hosted 47 school-sponsored blood drives in Cedar Rapids, which amounted to more than 1,300 red cell donations. There are only 34 school-sponsored blood drives scheduled in Cedar Rapids between January and June in 2021, which is anticipated to yield about 844 donations, a 38% decline locally, Hess said. Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center also saw a decline in school-based blood drives across the four-state region in 2021 when compared with a pre-pandemic year, representing a 41% loss in donating. In the first 6 months of 2019, the blood center held about 480 drives with school-sponsored groups that yielded more than 15,000 red blood cell donations. During the same period in 2021, the blood center has booked 401 school-based mobile blood drives, which is expected to collect about 9,000 donations. Businesses, churches, and other organizations that would host mobile blood drives on site have also canceled those events over the past year as employees worked from home or organizations closed as a safety precaution. In recent weeks, America's Blood Centers also reported many centers nationwide have seen their lowest donor turnout in more than a year. The Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center has been able to grow donations at fixed donor center locations by about 15 to 20% over previous years, Hess said, but those collections are not making up for mobile drive losses. Historically, May to July is a challenging time of year for blood centers. The Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center typically reports a supply shortage during the summer, when high schools, colleges are dismissed, and no longer hosting mobile blood drives. But heading into the season, while already facing a critical shortage, has national officials raising alarms about blood centers' ability to meet hospital needs. In a joint statement, National Blood Donation Centers urged Americans to sign up to donate soon. Doing so is essential to maintaining the availability of the nation's blood supply and ensuring life-saving treatments for patients in need, according to a statement from America's Blood Centers, the American Red Cross, and the American Association of Blood Banks. People still are eligible to donate blood if they have received a U.S.-approved COVID-19 vaccine. Vaccinated people should bring their vaccine cards to the blood collection site when donating. If they don't know which manufacturer produced the vaccine they received or received a vaccine outside the country, they should wait 2 weeks before giving blood, officials with National Blood Centers recommended. The Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center is adhering to strict infection control procedures to ensure donors aren't at risk for COVID-19 exposure, Hess said. That includes mandated masking and social distancing for donors at the collection sites. Hess said it's also safe to host mobile blood drives at sites like businesses or churches. Organizations are encouraged to contact the blood center if they are interested. Those interested in donating to the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center should schedule an appointment online at bloodcenter.org or by calling 1-800-747-5401. The article is accompanied by several color pictures of those making donations at the regional blood center collection sites in Cedar Rapids. Another story on the front page, UI's Herald says he would have given back millions to campus. This is reported by Vanessa Miller. Accepting praise Thursday from the Board of Regents as he prepares to retire after 6 years on the job, University of Iowa President Bruce Herold said he always planned to donate millions worth of deferred compensation he would have earned if he stayed longer back to campus. There's been a lot of speculation about why someone would want to give up their long-term incentive plan, and I just want to remind some of you, politely, that Mary and I have always planned on giving those funds back to the university, specifically to assist the university in relocating our cultural houses to Hubbard Park, Harold said while appearing virtually as the regents met in person on the campus. The Gazette has not previously reported Harold discussing plans to donate the $2.3 million worth of deferred compensation to the university. Board and UI officials would not answer questions Thursday about when and when he had previously announced that. The four cultural centers help create a home-away-from-home atmosphere and provide cultural education, leadership skills, and organizational development, according to the UI. The four are the Afro-American Cultural Center, the Latino Native American Cultural Center, the Asian Pacific American Cultural Center, and the Pride Alliance Center. The regents are meeting in person mostly in closed session at the Levitt Center on the Iowa City campus to interview four finalists selected to succeed Harold after he retires. They are expected to announce a new president today. The regents began their meeting Thursday in open session by reading a resolution expressing deep gratitude to President Harold for his expertise, dedication, an extraordinary service to the Board of Regents, the University of Iowa, its students and families, and all Iowans. The resolution praised Harold's pursuit of the $1.165 billion public-private partnership for the operation of the UI utility system. His decision to merge the UI Foundation and Alumni Association into one entity, external funding increases, and construction projects started or finished on his watch, including the Stead Family Children's Hospital, Hancher Auditorium, Catlett Residence Hall, and the new Stanley Museum of Art. when Harold on October 1st announced plans to retire 3 years before his contract was to expire and just 1 year after extending it. He said he wanted to give the board more time to choose a successor and vowed to stay until a new president started in hopes of a smooth transition. Harold suggested he could be here until 2023 or after. Buddy recently announced Regents President Mike Richards asked him to stay until May 16, the end of the semester. And despite earlier comments, Harold isn't planning to serve the board or the UI in another capacity until his contract expires, meaning he'll forego $2.3 million in deferred compensation. If the president's employment by the board terminates prior to July 1, 2023 for any reason other than his death, disability, or involuntary separation from the service without cause, the entire amount of the president's benefits shall be unconditionally forfeited by the president and shall be distributed by the trustee to the university, according to the compensation plan. The agreement does not mention a planned donation or terms for one. In his comments Thursday, Harold acknowledged that by retiring early, he's losing control of those funds in his family to donate them. But when it comes before you, it's our fervent hope that the board will look very favorably on this proposal to locate our cultural houses from the fringes of our campus to Hubbard Park, he said, and that the proceeds of our long-term incentive will be used to assist in funding this effort. In his remarks, Harold said, Hubbard Park, next to the Iowa Memorial Union, is right in the center of our campus, which is where I think the cultural centers belong. In response to questions about whether the university has drafted plans to move its cultural centers to Hubbard Park, including how much that might cost, a timeline, and what it would mean for the green space there, UI spokeswoman Janine Beck said the campus would need Board of Regents approval to proceed with planning. The university appreciates President Harold making the cultural centers a priority during his tenure, Beck said in a statement. Like with all major campus projects, the university would need to coordinate with Center for Advancement to determine potential philanthropic support and with campus planning and development. Leaders with the UI cultural centers didn't answer questions Thursday about the prospect of relocating the houses. A campus planning committee's meeting notes from October, 2 weeks after Harold announced his retirement, report that, quote, a neighborhood of the center of the cultural centers has been envisioned to create autonomy yet collaborative space in a more central location on the main campus, unquote. The notes added, the southwest segment of Hubbard Park has been identified as an optimal location. Discussion, including the appropriate space needs and the active sharing and celebrating of the history of the area of Iowa City as well as the namesake of the park. The park is named after Philip Hubbard, first black professor at the UI, who went on to become the first black vice president at a Big Ten institution. Though the Regents were meeting on his own campus, Harold did not attend in person. UI officials would not answer questions from the Gazette about why he did not attend or from where he was participating remotely. There was a virtual option, Regents spokesman Josh Lehman said, if anyone wanted to use it. He noted that members of the Presidential Search Committee also were participating remotely. And there is, of course, a picture of retiring President Bruce Harold. And still on the front page, we have a story by Trish Mahaffey. Mom sues Cedar Rapids over police dog attack of her black son. A Cedar Rapids mother this week filed a lawsuit against a Cedar Rapids police canine officer and the city, asserting excessive force was used on her 13-year-old son when he was wrongly attacked by a police dog and arrested in a stolen vehicle incident, quote, simply by virtue of his race and appearance, unquote. The mother, Tanya Marie Adams, filed an open records petition in November with the police department to get a copy of police body camera recordings and any other audio and video of her son's arrest last summer. She received video from a body camera recording in response and shared it with the Gazette after the lawsuit was filed on Wednesday. The lawsuit asserts excessive force was used by officers involved in the arrest, as well as canine officer Nathan Trimble and his canine partner, that there was negligence in police canine training and racial discrimination that amounted to reckless disregard for the rights and safety of others, including 13-year-old A.H., as he is identified in the lawsuit. The lawsuit comes on the heels of an $8 million settlement the city announced it would pay to black motorist Jareem Mitchell and his wife, Bracken, after he was shot and paralyzed in 2016 by a white police officer who was cleared by a grand jury but fired last year over departmental violations. In announcing the settlement, which is covered by insurance, the city did not admit wrongdoing. In this incident, the teen initially was arrested, but after being treated for injuries was released and not charged. Maria Johnson, Cedar Rapids Communications Manager, said the city doesn't comment on pending litigation. According to police reports, officers were pursuing suspects in a stolen vehicle investigation, which also may have included a gun. Reports indicated young black male suspects may have been in the area of 8th Street Northwest near Ellis Boulevard early on August 13, 2020. Brad Casper, an attorney for Adams, said two nights after the August 10 derecho left Cedar Rapids without power, the teen planned to spend the night with a friend, but there was a mix-up in communication and he ended up falling asleep in his friend's backyard in the 1100 block of 8th Street Northwest because nobody was home. The report provided by Casper said Officer Trimble, who is named in the suit, was with his 6-year-old police dog partner Ace and moving toward an alleyway directly behind an area where police had found one of the suspects hiding under a car. There was a large lot at 1100 8th Street Northwest with chopped up tree branches from the storm. Trimble said the report, which Ace started moving, let's do that again. Trimble in the report said Ace started moving around a metal trailer out of his view. A short time later, he heard screaming and saw Ace biting the upper arm of an individual partially hidden next to the logs. The lawsuit states Ace latched onto the youth's arm and refused release despite being commanded to do so. I moved up my leash to gain positive control of Ace's harness, Trimble said in the report. With the footing, it was extremely difficult to maintain balance on as the logs were all around and I fell down several times. I did verify that the subject had nothing in his hands. I grabbed a hold of Ace's collar and removed him. Casper previously said the teen didn't know why the dog had attacked him, and officers were yelling at him. The teen said officers threatened him with car theft and firearms charges, Casper said. The lawsuit states the police dog handled by Trimble has, in at least one previous incident, attacked a citizen without provocation or command. In this case, Trimble failed to adequately control the police dog as it, quote, sporadically darted throughout the neighborhood, unquote, the suit asserts. The report stated that after the teen was arrested, officers took him to Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital. Caspar said the medical report described the teen's injuries as deep lacerations and scrapings. He likely will have a lot of scarring, Caspar noted. The lawsuit asserts officers assumed A.H. was involved in the criminal activity because of his race and appearance. Officers didn't look for more information before searching, detaining, and arresting the 13-year-old, it alleges. Casper said after the teen was treated, the officers realized he wasn't involved in the crime and released him. The lawsuit states the attack and arrest has caused the teen physical and emotional injuries and damages. The article is accompanied by a photo showing the upper left arm area and shoulder with about three or four slashing-like scars that look pretty deep. Anyway, it's a good picture of the wounds incurred in the attack by the canine, the dog of the police department. And now it's time to turn to the Insight page and the Gazette's editorial. Listen to Iowans on water. A recently released survey by Iowa State University's Center for Agricultural and Rural Development found that most Iowans support providing funding to deal with water pollution issues. But there's a clear disconnect between the general public and the farmers over who is causing the problem and who should pay for cleanup. The Webb and Mayo survey was completed by 858 members of the general public across Iowa and by 493 farmers who live in the Raccoon River and Boone River watersheds in central Iowa. Just 32% of the general public surveyed believe Iowa's water quality is good or very good, compared with 55% of farmers. Two-thirds of the public surveyed said they see reducing nutrients such as nitrates and phosphorus in Iowa's waterways as very important or extremely important, compared to 43% of farmers. Although half the public sees the lake algae blooms fueled by excess nutrients as harmful, just 30% of farmers agree. 60% of the public see agriculture as the primary source of excess nutrients in lakes, compared to 32% of farmers. Iowa's nutrient reduction strategy, the state's blueprint for reducing pollutants, says 90% of nitrates and more than 60% of phosphorus in Iowa's waters comes from agricultural operations. Its assessment has been widely accepted for the better part of a decade. Asked how to pay for efforts to keep polluted runoff out of Iowa waterways, 52% of the public surveyed picked a special tax on fertilizer. The most popular pick among farmers, drawing the support of just more than 30%, is a recreation fee. We're heartened by the survey's findings that show Iowans clearly understand the state has a water quality problem. They don't want our lakes tainted by toxic algae blooms fed by fertilizer. They also know what the primary source of the problem is and chose a logical way to help fund nutrient reduction. All good news. Farm fertilizer is not subject to sales taxes in Iowa. Applying the sales tax could raise more than $100 million annually, according to a 2019 analysis by Common Good Iowa. Iowa also has the option of increasing a per-ton tax on fertilizer approved as part of the Groundwater Protection Act in 1987. A recreation fee to pay for pollution mitigation puts the onus on Iowans harmed by pollution, not the polluters themselves. That doesn't make sense. What would make far more sense is having elected leaders who listen to all Iowans when it comes to our water, not just a short list of agricultural organizations and interests that want to sustain the status quo. Iowans clearly want action, not just more dirty water. That's today's Gazette editorial. Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column, Pack House to Bolster Democracy. Iowa will cling to its four U.S. House seats for at least another decade, per U.S. Census figures published this week. The data show Iowa is growing but not keeping pace with the national rate. If that keeps up as expected, Iowa could lose a congressional seat in the next round of reapportionment, like seven states will this cycle. House membership has been arbitrarily capped at 435 for more than 100 years, except for a brief expansion when Hawaii and Alaska joined the Union. That means as the country grows, districts get more populous and Americans effectively become less represented. But there is an easy solution. Congress could simply expand the U.S. House. When Iowa was recognized as a state in 1846, the population was estimated at less than 100,000, but quickly growing. Iowans the next year voted in the state's first districted U.S. House elections. Members for the newly formed 1st and 2nd districts represented about 50,000 people each, making Iowans overrepresented in the Congress for a short time until the population caught up. Until the 1900s, House membership was regularly adjusted, usually increased, to reflect population changes. Our state topped out at 11 districts from 1883 to 1933, and our ranks in Congress have only dwindled since then under a fixed House size. In 2020, with nearly 3.2 million residents, Iowa's four U.S. House members represented an average of almost 800,000 people. My congresswoman's job is to represent everyone from Davenport to Lamoni, the quickest route between which is about 250 miles and takes you into two other congressional districts. I have made that drive, and it's not fun. People on opposite sides of the district don't think of themselves as living in the same economic and cultural region as the others. Their views and priorities, the things they want their federal representative working on, vary widely. Campaigning to 750,000 people is a lot different from campaigning to 50,000. The 2nd Congressional District, where I live, includes 24 county affiliates for each political party and parts of 5 TV markets. Candidates can't possibly meet a sizable share of their constituents, so they rely on big money campaigns and outside consulting companies. Most people who have contacted their member of Congress can attest to the cold and impersonal constituent service we tend to get. The response is often a form letter, if there is a response at all. Unsurprisingly, most Americans can't name their member of the House, polls show. The Constitution does not prescribe a certain number of members in the lower chamber. Congress could expand the House by passing a law, no constitutional amendment required. James Madison, called the Father of the Constitution, proposed an amendment that would have limited districts to 50,000 citizens. Representatives with too many constituents, quote, would not possess enough of the confidence of the people, unquote, he said at a 1787 convention. Those districts likely would be too small for modern America, necessitating more than 6,000 House members. But 750,000 constituents is surely too many. And that was Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column in today's Gazette. And finally, on the Insight page, we have one community letter, and that was submitted by Cecil Roper of Cedar Rapids. There's a science behind the meat ban debate. So, I heard on Fox News that President Joe Biden may be banning meat to combat global warming. Then I remembered that Colorado Democratic Governor Jared Polis had issued a proclamation calling for less meat consumption last month. My first reaction was, what kind of cockamamie idea will the Democrats cook up next? But then I read the article they quoted, and it made a bit more sense. Apparently, a University of Michigan research report found that replacing 50% of animal products with plant-based food would prevent more than 1.6 billion tons of greenhouse gases by 2030, which is Biden's target date for a 50% reduction in emissions. Another article I found in The Guardian argues that animal farming is a major driver of climate change, as well as air and water pollution, soil depletion, and construction or destruction of wildlife habitats. It's possible that in an environmentally sustainable world, we may eventually need to replace meat and other animal products with vegetables, fruits, and grains just as we replace fossil fuels with wind, solar, and other renewable energy sources. I may look and see what the internet and my local supermarket have to offer in terms of plant-based products. That was the letter submitted by Cecil Roper of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, April 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Among our other notices, from Cedar Rapids, Loy Fat Gibbs, 87, died Wednesday, April 28, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. From Cedar Rapids, Michael Mike R. Merritt, 73, died Saturday, April 24th, Tehan Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. From Cedar Rapids, Marilyn Johnson Nelson, 88, died Wednesday, April 28, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. From Decorah, Georgiana Wellborn, 81, died Tuesday, April 27th, Schluter Balick Funeral Home, Decorah. From Delta, Georgia Stout, 89, died Wednesday, April 28th, the Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Sigourney. From Iowa City, Laureen Fisher, 99, died Thursday, April 29, Lensing Funeral and Cremation, Iowa City. From Lamont, Robert William Rikers, R-E-I-C-H-E-R-S, William Robert Rikers, 84, died Thursday, April 29th, the Leonard Muller Funeral Home, Strawberry Point, and from Marshalltown, Donald Don Maston, 73, died Wednesday, April 28th, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. And now among our regular funeral submissions, we have from Marion Carl Jean Richards, 77, died peacefully Wednesday, April 28, at Mercy Medical Center, surrounded by family. Private services, 10 a.m. Monday, May 3rd, Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Public visitation will be held on Sunday, May 2nd, 2 to 5 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Burial will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From North English, Colleen Elizabeth Eckert died on Tuesday, April 27th at Compass Memorial Hospital in Marengo at the age of 66 years. Celebration of Life Memorial Service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, May 1st at the North English Christian Church. Pastor Luke Castor will officiate. Visitation Friday, 4 to 7 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in North English. Memorials are for esophageal cancer. Messages and tributes may be left at powellfuneralhomes.com in memory of Colleen Elizabeth Eckert of North English. From Cedar Rapids, Douglas Whitey Metz, 60, died Friday, April 23rd at Mercy Medical Center, Cedar Rapids. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Monday, May 3rd at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. The funeral service to follow immediately at the funeral home. Burial Linwood Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to the family of Douglas Whitey Metz of Cedar Rapids. From Peoria Heights, Illinois, Randall Randy Scott Mayering, M-A-H-R-I-N-G, Mayering, Sr., 69, of Peoria Heights, Illinois, passed away Saturday, April 24th in Orlando, Florida. A visitation will be Sunday, May 2nd, 3 to 5 p.m. at Remert for family and close friends. Online condolences may be submitted to Remert Funeral Home. I'll spell that R-E-M-M-E-R-T, RemertFuneralHome.com for Randall Randy Scott Mayering, M-A-H-R-I-N-G, of Peoria Heights, Illinois. and Randy had been born, was from Cedar Rapids. From Iowa City, Alan Al Young passed away April 28th at UI Hospitals and Clinics, the age of 74. To celebrate his life, a gathering for friends and family will be held Sunday, May 2nd, 2 to 5 p.m. at the Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service on Kirkwood Avenue in Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family or distributed to organizations that were important to Al. And full obituary may be read at the LansingFuneral.com website. You may share an online condolence and memory of Alan Al Young of Iowa City, the Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service. And from Shellsburg, Michael M. Wood, 72, died on Wednesday, April 28th at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Funeral service is 11 a.m. Saturday, May 1st at the Palo United Methodist Church. The Reverend John Howerton and Pastor Steve Pudinski officiating. Visitation 9 a.m. until service time at the church on Saturday. Burial will follow at the Oakwood Cemetery, Shellsburg. The casket will be closed to the public. Memorial contributions may be directed in memory of Michael M. Wood of Shellsburg to the Palo United Methodist Church, the Palo Food Pantry, or to the charity of the donor's choice. As an organ donor, Mike's spirit of giving continues after his death. The Van Steenhuis Funeral Home of Vinton, caring for Mike and his family. Condolences may be left at its website, vsrfh.com, for Michael M. Wood of Shellsburg. From West Branch, Donald J. Don Barnhart, 85, of rural West Branch, died suddenly Tuesday, April 27th, from an accident on his farm. Funeral services will be held 2 p.m. Sunday, May 2nd, at the Springdale United Methodist Church. There will be a time of visitation 1 hour prior to the services. Burial will be at the Friends Cemetery just north of Springdale. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in Don's memory to Springdale United Methodist Church, and to share memories and condolences with the family, visit the funeral home website, gayandsia.com. That's for Donald J., known as Don Barnhart of West Branch. And finally, from Petersburg, Illinois, Daryl, known as Big D, Lee Strope, 66. He was of Petersburg, Illinois, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Passed away peacefully April 27 at Lutheran Living Home in Muscatine. Per his wishes, there will be no services. Online condolences may be left for the family at sandfuneralservice.com. Snyder and Hohenbaugh Funeral and Cremation Services of Muscatine is caring for Daryl's arrangements and his family. Condolences may be sent to on behalf of Daryl Big D. Lee Strope to Patricia Strope, 3377 Schmickle Road, that's S-C-H-M-I-C-K-L-E, Schmickle Road, Marion, Iowa, 52302. And that concludes the list of obituaries in today's Gazette. And now it's time to turn to the sports pages for a couple of high school sports stories. One of them is track and field, the other is in golf. First in track and field, from Tiffin, Jeff Linder reports, Figueroa shines at Pacia Relays. One surgery is behind, another most likely lies ahead. In the meantime, Alex Figueroa simply deals with the pain and does what he can, which is still quite a bit. I've gotten better at managing it, handling it, he said. I do a lot of short workouts. If the guys run 10 reps, I might do 6. Despite the pain and the limited conditioning, Figueroa, a senior at Clear Creek Amana, is one of the fastest guys around. He won four events in last night's Pacer Relays. He was a member of the Clippers winning sprint medley relay, captured the 100, actually more like 95, due to a clerical error in which Sprinter started at the wrong line, and 200 when anchored, then anchored CCA to victory in the 400 meter relay. He said, "After the 100, I was feeling really good, but I knew I couldn't get too big of a head. Pain can humble you in a hurry," said Figueroa, "and Figueroa is battling compartment syndrome, a painful condition that occurs when pressure within the muscles builds to high levels in his legs. The only way to fix it is surgery," he said. "I'm pretty much day to day." Figueroa had an unrelated surgery about after football season and didn't run for 3 months after that. The Clippers won 11 of 19 events and scored 156 points, outdistancing Solon by 10.5. Solon rolled to the girls' title, tallying 179 points. Davenport Assumption was the runner-up with 136. Emma Bach anchored three winning relays for the Spartans. "I don't usually run the 4x2, so I was really excited about that," Bach said. "I always enjoy running relays, winning something together." Tipton distance ace Caleb Schumacher survived a grueling day, winning the boys 3,200 and 1,600 and winning a pair of 800s. "I really like to treat these meets like competitive workouts," he said. "This is a good workout for my legs. I'm tired, but more than anything, I'm hungry. There's a cliff bar calling me. Then I'll run a 2 mile cool down so my legs don't feel like jello when I get off the bus." CCA girls coach Jane Astor, who will retire at the conclusion of the season after 32 years, was recognized midway through the meet. The school's Creek Classic will be renamed the Jane Astor Relays. There is a picture of a Jane Astor getting a hug from one of her athletes during the mid-season, or the mid-event presentation, as mentioned in the article. And there are a couple of pictures, one of them in the men's event, of them doing the hurdles, and a couple of women relay runners running toward the camera, as in the patient relays, as reported last night. And now turning to the golf story, reported by KJ Pilcher. Solon ranks among Class 3A golf leaders. Solon coach Adam Staley was cautiously optimistic for this season. Like many coaches, he had questions about the impact of no 2020 season. Upperclassmen's routines were disrupted. Underclassmen miss important experience. Staley, I'm going to spell that S-T-A-H-L-E, Staley or Stahl, this could be, Staley still recognized the Spartans' potential. "I know the kids that we had put in a lot of time on the golf course, and usually that is a correlation to playing well, but until it happens, you don't really know," Staley said. "It's been really fun to see these kids succeed. All the credit goes to them." Solon ranks among the Class 3A leaders in team scoring and have won 7 of 9 events, placing second or better in each before Thursday's meet at Terra Hills Country Club in Van Horn. The Spartans are 37-2 with two close finishes to 2A contender West Branch. "Every one of these kids has worked his tail off," Staley said. "A number have put in time on the golf course in years past, or getting into the weight room, and everything that goes along with making a well-rounded athlete." The Spartans rank 3rd in combined adjusted average, 164.11, and 18-hole adjusted average, 325.90, which factors in course difficulty. The combined adjusted average is good for 6th in all classes. They are 2nd in 3A with a 315.5 18-hole average. Balance and good-natured competition have been a key component to the strong season. The top four on the team are all within two strokes of scoring leader Frank Hagee Jr.'s 77.25 18-hole average and less than three strokes in combined adjusted average. Stetson McIlravy is second with a 78.33 average per round. Brothers Jack and Mac McCarty shoot 79 and 79.25 per 18, respectively. Lucas Tepul shoots in the mid-80s with Brennan Heesch and Nathan Miller rounding out the balanced lineup. The inaugural Iowa City Invitational, dubbed Clash for the Club, that features all four Iowa City High School girls golf programs, was held Monday at Finkbein Golf Course. Iowa City Liberty claimed dibs on the traveling trophy, shooting 389 and topping runner-up Iowa City West by 31 strokes. Bella Peterson earned medalist honors for Liberty, firing 80. She was followed by senior teammate Neely Morris, who carded an 86. Wes Leah Pesha and Riley Goodfellow finished third and fourth, respectively. The event is similar to other intra-city trophy contests like the Battle for the Boot in football and volleyball's Battle for the Spike between City High and West. City High and Liberty Football introduced the Titans Trophy last fall as part of their football rivalry. Washington, Iowa boasts the top two Class 3A golfers in combined adjusted average. Seniors Kiki Bruner and Anna Nakos are first and second with 38.72 and 39.17 respectively. Both also rank among 3A's best in all other scoring categories, sitting one and two in two more. Nakos is first in 18-hole adjusted average, while Bruner leads 18-hole average. And now we go back to the Iowa Today page by a story reported by Trish Mahaffey. Defense expert doesn't dispute DNA findings in Robbins's trial. Some cases involving DNA come down to a battle of the experts, but a defense DNA expert testifying for Matthew Robbins, accused of robbing and fatally shooting James Boer in 2014, agreed with the prosecution's experts. Michael Spence, forensic DNA consultant and owner of Spence Forensic Resources of Las Cruces, New Mexico, on Thursday agreed with the findings of the prosecution's DNA forensic examiner or a state crime lab analysts, slightly refining two results. Spence couldn't say, because of inconclusive evidence, whether bone fragments found in a burn pit at an Ely farmhouse where Robbins lived in 2014 belonged to Boer, I'll spell that name B-O-O-H-E-R, Boer, 51 of Marion. He agreed with Charity Davis, an FBI nuclear forensic examiner at the FBI lab in Quantico, Virginia, who testified Tuesday that there were two DNA contributors to the bone fragments. Spence found one contributor was a female. In her testimony, Davis said she couldn't completely rule out that one could be a female, but that one was definitely a male. Robbins is accused of robbing and killing Boer, a drug dealer, on May 31, 2014. He is charged with robbery affecting interstate commerce, conspiracy to commit robbery affecting interstate commerce, and using, carrying, and brandishing a firearm during a crime of violence resulting in murder. The defense wrapped up its case in U.S. District Court on Thursday morning without Robbins testifying. Closing arguments were in the afternoon, with the jury beginning deliberations today. Robbins, if convicted, faces a mandatory 10 years in prison, up to life. He already is serving a 10-year federal prison sentence for being a felon and an unlawful drug user after a 2015 conviction. In last week's testimony, more than one witness said Robbins fatally shot Boer with a sawed-off shotgun and burned his body in a burn pit in back of the farmhouse. One witness was Robbins' former girlfriend, Danielle Bush, who has been convicted in the case and was at the house when the alleged killing happened. Others testified Robbins had confessed to them. The witnesses said Robbins killed Boer because he was angry that Boer repeatedly told him amphetamine mixed with bath salts, reducing its quality or potency. Spence, the New Mexico DNA expert, on Thursday said he didn't have a lot of experience analyzing human remains, but had reviewed a webinar this year on removing DNA from bones for testing. He agreed with the FBI's Davis and Tara Scott, an Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation criminalist. Boer's DNA was found on walls, a vent cover, and a glove at Robbins' house. In other testimony Thursday, Jeff Vossel of Cedar Rapids said he has been good friends with Robbins since they were 14 or 15 years old and used to hang out at Robbins' home in Ely. He said he was there a few weeks before May 19, 2014. On cross-examination, Vossel denied seeing Robbins use drugs and didn't know he had been convicted on firearms and drug charges. Assistant U.S. Attorney Lisa Williams noted Vossel visited Robbins in jail and gave him money, but Robbins hid things from him. Vossel said he didn't think of it at the think of it that way, saying he understood a person might not want others to know some things about their life. And there is a picture of Matthew Robbins included with the article. And we'll conclude with another story on the Iowa Today page from Iowa City, reported by Lee Hermiston, Iowa City Police investigating fatal shooting. Iowa City Police are investigating a fatal shooting that happened Wednesday night. Officers are called to the 2400 block of Lakeside Drive around 8:04 p.m. Wednesday for a report of shots fired and found a man who had been shot, according to a news release. He was taken to University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, where he was pronounced dead. Police are waiting to notify the man's family before publicly identifying him. No arrests have been announced in the case, which remains under investigation by the police department, Johnson County Medical Examiner's Office, and Johnson County Attorney's Office. The incident marks Iowa City's second fatal shooting this year. Officers were called to 615 South Governor Street November 6th at 7:53 p.m. Let's see. That's not right. On Governor Street, number 6, that's the apartment number, at 7:53 p.m. February 12th, for a report of a man being shot and killed during a robbery. Multiple people were reported to have been present during the robbery. Police arrived and found Quincy Russum, 19, dead. Police said Sammy Imadine Helmed, 22, a transient, was one of the people inside the apartment when Russum was killed. Police also learned the shooting had occurred more than 30 minutes before it was reported. Helmed was arrested later in February and faces one count of first-degree murder, a Class A felony, punishable by an automatic life sentence. He has pleaded not guilty and is scheduled to go on trial August 17th, according to court records. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, April 30th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.